And as we turn there this morning, I don't want you to panic. Because none of you were thinking of panicking until I mentioned that. And now you're wondering what you should or shouldn't be panicking about. But I don't want you to panic today. When we meet Jesus in these verses, we're in a situation where we might expect Jesus to panic if we didn't know more about him. That he's there facing interrogation by these powerful leaders. He's being pulled in different directions. And he gets his fate decided by this shouting mob of people who say, "Crucify." And all of this happening after he's had the opposite of a good night's sleep, and he's had a bad night and he wasn't able to sleep. He went straight from his arrest to having these interrogations, and now it's early in the morning and he's faced more hostile questioning. Yet in all of that, he doesn't panic. He doesn't crack under the pressure. Even in the stress of the situation, which he must have felt as a man, he comes across as being remarkably calm, doesn't he, in everything that he faces. And I want us today to look at Jesus' responses in this interrogation with Pilate, the Roman governor. And as we look at Jesus' responses in this situation, I want us to see why we can have confidence today in a world where power often seems to be in the wrong hands. In a world where, in the words of Psalm 2, the nations rage and the peoples plot. I want us to see the confidence we can have and how we can, in a very real spiritual sense, keep calm and carry on, to coin a phrase. And so that's what we're going to look at with this interrogation. And as we look at what happens from verse 28 onwards, we meet some people at the governor's headquarters in Jerusalem. The Roman governor, Pilate, meets some people playing tug of war. Not actually tug of war, but that's the kind of image that comes to my mind. Are you all familiar with tug of war? You have this long rope. I was tempted to bring one this morning and Pat and I could, but I didn't. This long rope, and you have these two groups of people trying to get control of the rope and to cause the other team to fall over and lose. That image of the tug of war rope has been in my mind as I've looked at this situation, because you have these Jewish authorities and these Roman authorities who are struggling for control of the situation about what's going to happen to Jesus. In one way, they're united against Jesus, but in another way, there's this struggle for control and power. And so these religious leaders and their officers bring Jesus to Pilate, the Roman governor, recognizing that they need Pilate's authorization to move things forward in their plan of dealing with Jesus. And as they arrive at the governor's headquarters, they decide that they'll get ahead slightly by making him come out of his house. They're not going to go in, they're going to make him come out. And the reason they make him come out, we're told in verse 28, they themselves did not enter the governor's headquarters so that they would not be defiled but could eat the Passover. Their concern at this point is with defilement, of remaining religiously and ritually pure so they could take part in the feast. That's their reasoning, which is an interesting stance to take, isn't it? To be obsessed about remaining pure while you're in the process of handing over the Holy One of God to be executed. It's an interesting stance to take, but that's the one they take. And they don't go in, they stay out. Just a quick comment on that word Passover, where it says that they would be able to eat the Passover. Those of you who are Bible readers may be thinking, well, hasn't Jesus already eaten the Passover? Hasn't that already happened? You know, the Last Supper with his disciples, a Passover meal. So is it that these people missed out, or is this contradicting what we read in the other Gospels of that Passover meal? I think probably the way we should understand this is by remembering that Passover, as a kind of a day, was the first day of a week-long feast. It's called the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And the word Passover, we see, even in the Gospel accounts, we see it can be used to refer to the meal that Jesus ate, the Passover meal, or to refer to that first day of the feast, or to refer to the whole thing, the whole week of that feast, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, as the Passover. And so I think what's probably happening here is that they may have had that Passover meal like Jesus did, but there's still more to come, and they want to make sure they can make the most of this Feast of Unleavened Bread, so they don't want to be defiled. And the reason that John gives us that word Passover is because he wants the Passover to be in our minds as we approach the death of Jesus. And why is that? Come back on Good Friday and you'll find out. But for now, we'll continue through what happens in John 18. As these religious leaders and their representatives come, that Pilate aims to take charge of the situation. He tightens his grip on the rope. And he asks what is, sounds like quite a reasonable question. In verse 29, what accusation do you bring against this man? That seems like a reasonable thing to ask, doesn't it? Now, those who brought him aren't really interested in having a discussion about that. They just want Pilate to get on with doing what they've already decided needs to be done. So they give this interesting response, verse 30. If this man were not doing evil, we would not have delivered him over to you. They just want Pilate to do what they've decided needs to be done. They just want Pilate to do their bidding. Now, Pilate pulls back on the rope at that point and says, well, if you know what needs to be done, just do it yourself. Take him yourselves and sort him out. I don't want to get involved if I don't need to. That would be silly. Just go and sort him out yourself. Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law. Because when Pilate pulls back, there's not much movement because the Jews have also decided not only that he's guilty, but the sentence should be death and death by crucifixion, and they can't do that. And so they say it's not lawful for us to put anyone to death. And they want it to happen. So there's that struggle for control, and things don't work out the way Pilate would have wanted. He's on the back foot a bit. But at this point, having been outside, he goes back inside. And now at last, surely, he'll be in control of proceedings because he's going as the representative of Roman power, going to interrogate this prisoner, this suspect. But even when he's interrogating this prisoner, things don't go according to plan for Pilate, and he keeps losing his grip on the rope. Things get out of his control. His role is to ask Jesus questions. That's what happens in interrogation, isn't it? When you have an interview, people ask you questions. But what ends up happening is that Jesus asks him questions back, and he ends up being put on a kind of, in a trial, interrogated, that he says to Jesus, "Are you the King of the Jews?" And Jesus asks him, well, what's making you say that? Is that something you've just heard and are repeating? What do you think, Pilate? Do you say this of your own accord, or did others say it to you about me? And as we go through the interrogation, we can imagine Pilate getting a bit more impatient as things just aren't going according to plan for him. This is not what he wanted to happen when this group of people turned up at his door with Jesus. And it ends with him saying in verse 38, what is truth? And it's not a serious question he's asking, is it? He's not actually going away from this thinking, oh, that's a good question. What is truth? I need to think about that for a bit. It's not a serious question. This is I've had enough of this conversation. Let's just get on with it. If something's going to happen, let's just get on with it. What is truth? Dismissive. And having been inside for a bit, he goes outside again. And as he goes outside, he has this final opportunity to assert his power as the representative of Rome, to show that he's in control of things. And he points to this Passover custom. And the whole idea of the custom was that there'd be a prisoner that would be released, who could enjoy that freedom during the week-long Passover festival. And so he goes out to this crowd that are there, and he says, this Jesus, I can't find anything wrong that he's done wrong. I can't find any guilt in him that would cause me to have to do anything about him. And so, you've got this custom. Do you want me to release to you the King of the Jews? And he's hoping that by doing that, he can get Jesus off his hands and that Jesus will be released. Of course, the crowd pull the rope in a different direction. And rather than saying, yes, let's have Jesus released, they demand Barabbas to be released. And we're told Barabbas was a robber, which is a bit of an understatement. We read from the other gospel accounts that he was involved in an uprising. He was a murderer. This is not just stealing handbags on Jerusalem High Street. He's been guilty of murder. And no one's disputing he's guilty, by the way. They don't say, Free Barabbas, he's been the victim of a miscarriage of justice. They seem as guilty, but they want him to be released. And Jesus to be kept for the sentencing. There's this struggle for power going on, and things really don't work out in Pilate's favour. Things don't work out the way he had wanted. But while all of this power struggle is going on, while this tug-of-war game is happening, again, I come back to that picture we have of Jesus in this interrogation, that he doesn't panic, that in the stress of the situation which he must have felt, he is remarkably calm. He's able to give these clear answers to Pilate after a night of not sleeping. And in the middle of that interrogation, he makes one really significant statement they want us to look at. One really significant statement that helps us to understand his confidence and his calm confidence, and that can give us confidence today as well. The one significant statement I want to look at, we will look at another one as well, but the one I want us to look at now is that statement in verse 36, where Jesus says, "My kingdom is not of this world." And again he says at the end of the verse, "My kingdom is not from the world." I want us to think about that statement for a bit. Pilate's asking him, "Are you king?" Clearly he's been told some stuff that's not recorded here. And so he asks Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus doesn't reply with a simple yes or no, because he is a king, but he's not the kind of king that Pilate is thinking of. That's the issue. So he's not like the kings of the world, and his kingdom is not like the kingdoms of this world. He's not like the kings of this world who establish their position with military force or with money, connections, influence. He's not like those kind of kings. If he was like those kind of kings, then he says, "My servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews." If he was one of those kings like the kings of the world, he would have been taking his disciples to sword fighting training ready for this great showdown in the garden last week. He wouldn't have told Peter to put the sword away. He'd have told Peter to keep cutting off more and more ears at other parts as well. But he's not that kind of king, because his kingdom is not from this world. And what does that mean? Well, in one way, it means that Pilate and Jesus are not in competition with each other here. And Pilate thinks that means he doesn't need to be concerned about Jesus. That's what Pilate thinks. We can imagine Pilate's thinking a bit like this, that over here, I have two pictures. Over here you have the kingdoms of the world, and over here you have the kingdom of Jesus. And there's no connection between the two. The kingdom of Jesus has nothing to do with the kings of the world. They're just completely separate things. And so Pilate doesn't need to be concerned about Jesus, because he's over here and Jesus is over here. But that's not what Jesus is saying. Because if Jesus' kingdom is not from the world, where is it from? It's from above. It's from heaven. That Jesus is a king who comes not with earthly authority, but with heavenly authority, divine authority. He's a king who is above all of the other powers and authorities in this world, including Pilate and all the chief priests who opposed him. So there is a way in which Pilate should be concerned about Jesus, but Jesus doesn't need to be concerned about Pilate, because whatever plotting the kings of the earth may do, whatever plotting and power struggles may be happening with Pilate and the religious leaders, Jesus' kingdom is not affected by any of that. Jesus' role as king is not shaken by any of those power struggles, because his kingdom is not from this world, it's something different from above. You could think back to that psalm I read at the beginning, Psalm 2. Maybe we want to go home and read it again after what we've looked at this morning, and the picture at the beginning of all these nations raging and all these peoples plotting. With all of the activity and noise on earth, when we look up to heaven, we see a scene of great calm, with the Lord even laughing and saying, "As for me, I've set my king on Zion, my holy hill, appointing his son to be king forever." That Jesus has been appointed king not on the basis of military power, but by that eternal divine decree. And one day, all of the kings will need to bow before him. My kingdom is not of this world. And in fact, Pilate here, in a sense, is acting as a servant of King Jesus. He doesn't realize that. He doesn't realize that's what he's doing. But Pilate is acting as a servant of King Jesus. Look down at verse 32. All of this, this power struggle and the tug of war and everything that comes from it, this was to fulfill the word that Jesus had spoken to show by what kind of death he was going to die. That Pilate is part of the process by which Jesus' words are fulfilled. The process by which what Jesus said would happen does actually happen, including him being handed over to be crucified by the Roman authorities. That what happens here in John 18 is not a threat to Jesus' kingdom. This is part of how his kingdom is built, as Jesus is handed over to be killed and then to rise again. That what happens here in John 18 is part of how Jesus fulfills the purpose that he came into this world for. That purpose we get in that other significant statement of Jesus in verse 37. "You say that I am a king." Again, he doesn't answer directly because he's not the kind of king that Pilate is thinking of. He's a king who comes into the world with this purpose. Eternal Son coming into the world with this purpose to bear witness to the truth. That's why Jesus came into this world. We're told that at the beginning of John's Gospel, came to this world full of grace and truth. The Son from the Father, coming to show us who God really is and how we can know him. He later said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." He bore witness to the truth by being the truth, by being the revelation of God to us, showing us what God is like as the eternal Son. And after these words in John 18, he's going to go on to bear witness to the truth even more powerfully when he dies on the cross. And there on the cross, as Jesus dies, we see so clearly that God is a God of love, who so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life. That at the cross we're reminded that we deserve to perish as people who have sinned. That none of us have listened to God's truth in the way that we should have done. None of us have lived in line with God's truth as we should have done. We've all disobeyed and sinned. And God is a just and holy God. You can't just ignore sin and pretend it hasn't happened. You can't just look down at this world that he cares about and just ignore sin. What we deserve for our sin is what's described here in this famous Bible verse as perishing. For us to appear before King Jesus on a day of judgment and for him to say, "Get away from me." For us to be shut out from his kingdom forever. Shut out into darkness. It's what we deserve. But there at the cross, we see a God of justice who is also a God of love and mercy. There we see God the Son laying down his life in our place for us, so that we can be forgiven, so we can know life instead of death, so we can be welcomed into his kingdom, not shut outside, but welcomed in. This kingdom from above, this heavenly kingdom, this eternal kingdom, that we can come and live with him as king. That we can know his rule and his guidance and his help in our lives now. And we can look forward to the day when we'll hear these words that John records in the last book of the Bible. The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. A day when we'll see a perfect reign of peace without even a hint of opposition standing against Jesus. A perfect reign of life with death abolished for all of Jesus' people. A perfect reign of Jesus, the perfect King for his people to enjoy forever and ever. That's the truth that he came to bear witness about. That's the reason he went to his death on the cross, why he went through the arrest and the interrogation and the crucifixion. And as he stood there, bound as a prisoner, interrogated by Pilate, he knew that all of this power play and these power struggles and this tug of war, it couldn't challenge his status as king. It couldn't stop his kingdom coming. It couldn't stop his kingdom growing as people come and hear the truth. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I've come into the world to bear witness to the truth. Everyone is of the truth, listens to my voice. And as those who are of the truth listen to his voice, so the kingdom grows as we look forward to that final glorious day when Jesus will come back. My kingdom is not of this world, says Jesus. Something far above that, far more glorious. Which brings with it today both a warning and an encouragement. And before we sing and then eat and drink together, I want us to think briefly about that warning and that encouragement that comes from these words of Jesus. The warning that comes for us today is the warning, don't be like Pilate. Pilate here is an example of how not to respond to Jesus, and we need to hear the warning today. Pilate, as he goes through the interrogation, he doesn't really know who Jesus is, and tragically, he doesn't really care. He just tries to avoid making a decision about Jesus. He doesn't really want anything to do with it. For him, this is not about the question of who Jesus is, it's just about his own position of authority and power and how he can manipulate that. He tries to avoid a decision about Jesus. But Jesus is not someone that we can avoid making a decision about. Jesus is not someone that we can just ignore. Jesus is not someone we can stay neutral about and say it doesn't really matter. Jesus is the eternal King at whose feet we will all one day fall. We'll either fall in the joy of worship or in the reality of judgment. But he is the King, at his feet we will all one day fall. And he is the way, the truth, and the life, and one day we won't be able to escape that reality. No one will be able to avoid that reality, however hard they try. This one who is the King, the way, the truth, and the life. And that question that Pilate asked in verse 38, what is truth? Because Pilate didn't actually care about the answer. He just wanted the conversation to end. But that question does come to all of us this morning. Have you found the answer to that question? Have you found that the answer to the question of truth is not really a what, but a who? The truth isn't a thing, it's a person, it's Jesus, who came to this world to show us what God is like and how we can know God. This Jesus who shows us God in his life and his death and his rising again invites us to come and find life in his kingdom. Have you come to know Jesus as this truth, as this King? If you're not sure what to make of Jesus, maybe you've been coming to church for a bit, or maybe this is your first time for a while, and you're not sure what to make of Jesus, take the warning of Pilate. And please don't rest until you have an answer. Don't just stand in indecision, say it doesn't matter. Don't rest until you have an answer of who Jesus is and what your response to him needs to be. Until you can come to Jesus and say, Jesus, I'm sorry for my sin. Thank you for dying for me. Please forgive me and help me to live with you as King. Please help me to look forward to the day when you'll come back to make everything new. Have you come to see that truth? Are those words that you've said that you can say? If you want to know more about Jesus and you're not sure what to make of him, please keep coming to our Easter services, or I'll be around. You can chat to me afterwards. I'd love to talk to you more about this Jesus. That's the warning, but I do want us to look at the encouragement as well. The encouragement for those of us who do know Jesus as King, and Jesus as the way, the truth, and the life. Encouragement for us that we don't need to panic. We don't need to panic. All of us have seen changes in our society in our lifetime. Some of you have seen more than others because you've been alive for a lot longer. But we've all seen changes in society. And sometimes as Christians, I feel like we'd be very good at panicking when we think about how things have changed. When we think about how we talk about how we're not a Christian country anymore. We think about the census results or church attendance. Or we think about what's taught in schools or what's prioritised among adults. Or how when you go to Sainsbury's and look at the East aisle, there's nothing to do with Jesus at all. Or how you think about how certain politicians face such criticism for both believing certain things and then having the audacity to say what they believe. And we can panic about this situation that we see around us, especially those of you who remember a very different kind of society not so long ago. But when we see Jesus in John 18, we remember we don't need to panic. These are things we should be concerned about, yes. And there are things in our society that we should lament and even weep over. And there are situations where we need to think about acting and we need to pray. And this week, on Wednesday, we've got Gareth Edwards coming from the Christian Institute. There are things that we need to be concerned about. But we don't need to panic. Because Jesus is King. And his kingdom isn't founded on political policies or school curricula or money or influence or any of those things. It's founded on the eternal divine decree. It's guaranteed by Jesus dying and rising again, the Jesus who will return in glory one day. It's not dependent on the resources of this world, because his kingdom is not of this world. So we can keep calm and carry on to keep going with the work he's called us to bear witness to the truth. Of course, we bear witness to the truth in a different way from Jesus because we're not the eternal Son of God, but we're called to be his witnesses, and we can get on with being his witnesses because we know that Jesus is King. And as we bear witness about the truth, we may feel sometimes like we're being put on trial, we're facing interrogation, hostile questioning for speaking about Jesus and what we believe of him. But even in that interrogation, Jesus stands with us, gives us his heavenly resources, so we can keep worshipping him as King. We can keep on bearing witness to the truth, and we can keep on praying, your kingdom come. Let me pray for us now.